Hey, man, how you doing?
Hey, what's going on?
Good. Just taking it easy. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Yeah, we can do this today if you want. You know, you want to do it now? I mean, what's your schedule? You know?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
Let's have a conversation about Northern Virginia music from back in the day.
Let's do it.
Up to today. So, you know, I know a little bit about, you know, your time in United Mutation, and I know a little bit about DSI Records, but I really don't know a lot about you yourself. So,
okay.
I was just wondering, like, where you're from originally and how you got interested in music as a kid.
Okay. Well, I'm from Washington, D.C., and born and raised in Northern Virginia, Arlington primarily, and Falls Church. Music has always been our life. I mean, my father played drums in the Shriners. He was a Shriner drummer in the marching band. So we always had drums, and we're going out to see him playing, and he was practicing a lot, and that kind of. So we had drums, you know, in family. We had, you know, our parents liked music, and we had a little turntable, you know, from an early age, and you know, not a lot of cool records, but I mean, you know, as we grew up and started buying records, and one thing led to another, and you know, we started playing.
Did your dad teach you guys how to play?
Nah, not really. It's like, I mean, we'd play along with him, but, you know, make noise along with him. But, yeah, you know, not really, you know. But, I mean, you pick that up a little bit, too, you know, just the regimenting of, you know, the drum beat and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's, you know, you see it constantly, and you kind of, you know, just sort of becomes a natural thing, I guess, as well. The guitar was just like my cousin had a guitar for sale, and I was kind of interested in rock and roll at that time. And my dad kind of pushed me into getting the guitar and amp, and that kind of got us started. And then as time progressed, I mean, we started writing our own songs probably in 1980 or something. And as we were into punk rock, and thought we could do it ourselves. So,
How did you get into punk rock, and like, what was the progression? What were you into before that, and then what was the change?
We were always like into rock and roll, like heavy, Black Sabbath and Ted Nugent and all of the heaviest of the heavy and crazy stuff, and Alice Cooper, things that, you know, oddity, weird stuff of any sort, and punk rock sort of was, there was some TV show on, I think it was like 76 or must have been 76 or something in England, about like the punks in England. And I think Jay and I both discovered that, my brother Jay is in United Mutation also, both discovered that at the same time, even living in different towns. It was like, we still sort of, you know, latched onto that. And, The high school, we met kids who were had some records and lent us the Devo and some other stuff, and it was cool. And but probably I'd say WGTB radio station here in D.C. was playing punk rock music, like real punk rock music, back in as early as probably like 77, 76, 77, 78. So that's probably was what really got us into it. And then we're too young to go to shows at that point, pretty much. But we, about like 70s, early 80s, we started, you know, checking out Slicky Boys and bands like that. So it was a good local scene before hardcore. We'll be right back.
We haven't talked much about that on this show.
Oh, well, like the Slicky Boys are from Maryland, and then the band The Raz, and there was a whole bunch of good bands. Limp Records that Skip Groff put out of his Yesterday and Today shop up in Maryland. They, I mean, just about everything. Black Market Baby came out of that. The Nurses. I mean, there was all these crazy great bands. And we were going to record stores and buying records, and we saw these other things, and we're like, hey, let's give it a shot, you know. And it just totally loved it, man. Right off the bat, it was like inspiring, and again, the kind of thing we're like, hey, we can do this. Then Teen Idols came along, and that kind of like changed everything again. So.
Were any of those bands from Northern Virginia? Were any of those bands local to you?
Well, not like in the neighborhood necessarily. I mean, you know, some of the Slicky Boys lived in Virginia, and the Nurses, I think, lived in Arlington. So there were some. I mean, most of the people were in Maryland or in D.C. So back then.
And was there anywhere to go see them without going over the river, or were you always going into D.C. if you wanted to see a show?
Not necessarily. I mean, there was, you know, a few rock clubs like Louis Rock City and Bailey's Crossroads area was like a big rock establishment place that they might have done the Ramones once. I mean, it wasn't a punk type place or punk friendly in any way. It was like just a real like a hippie greaser, rednecky, long hair bar type thing. You know? Not that there's anything wrong with that because I was long hair then too. But it was, you know, I mean, it was not like a punk friendly. I mean, most people weren't punk friendly. I mean, most people thought it was crazy, and you know, like still, pretty much, people just don't latch on to there being any importance here. So, but yeah, no, there was some stuff. But yeah, most of the time when we went, I mean, we didn't really start going to shows until the early '80s, and most of the time we'd go down to DC to see shows. So. There were some good places in Georgetown also in the early 80s. And you could, you know, I mean, you could walk across the bridge. I mean, it wasn't that hard to, like, get into Georgetown. So it's like, you know, didn't have to drive necessarily. So, but, you know, when you get up into town, you know, it's pretty much we've been all the time. So when we could.
Initially, were you attracted to the music just on its own, or were you attracted to the culture of it too?
Definitely the culture and all of it. I mean, we were hippie types, and, you know, we were politically active in the 70s, and, like, we'd go to, like, protests and things like that. Just because, I mean, it was in our blood. I mean, we just wanted to, like, we had something to say, and, you know, we wanted to get out. And I guess, you know, the yippies kind of in D.C., which is the Youth International Party, kind of, I don't know, they used to put on, like, big shows on the mall on the 4th of July for the Smoke-In and get like Dead Kennedys and people to play. And it kind of, you know, they were trying to like bridge a gap there, but I mean, it still was like the long hair and the short hair thing just never seemed to jive. So, but yeah, we liked the whole craziness of the music, the DIY aspect of it, you know, the political part of it, even though D.C. wasn't very political at that point. You know, our songs, we always were trying to, like, be kind of either super political or tongue-in-cheek political or, you know, I mean, we you know, we grew up in D.C., so we saw politics, and it was part of our life and you know, on a daily basis. And that's kind of where I got my influences as far as the you know, wanting to put music out too. Is just, you know, we have a message here, and let's write some songs that mean something. We wanted to expose Reagan's and people like that, and big business, and you know, the industries that are just continuing to bring us down. So, not to get too political.
So when you made those first songs, who were the guys that you were getting together with and doing this first hit?
It was Jay, my brother, and Noel Hollingshead, who wrote lyrics and sang, and John Harden, who was the singer before Mike Brown, before we were United Mutation, and played guitar as well. So we kind of had our own little neighborhood band thing that we started up about 1980, 81, something like that, and started writing songs. And it was like Sons of Sunoco was like one of our first songs, which was basically about the oil companies. And, you know, so it's, they're kind of hokey and have some comedy to them also, because we don't take ourselves all that seriously. Although, you know, we had a message, we also had a sense of humor.
Was that band called Dark Self-Image?
It had a lot of different names. Dark Self-Image would be the core name for all of those groups. The way we look at back at it now, it's sort of, yeah, it would be basically, that would have been the core beginning of Dark Self-Image. Although I don't remember exactly what we were calling it at that point, because we had, like, we'd come up with different names all the time. Like, we'd do cassettes for our friends who were off at college, and we'd record some songs and put some new records on the thing and send them off. And so usually we'd change the names of the band around all the time just to, you know, keep them guessing. Dark Self-Image is basically, all of that is under the umbrella. It's kind of a Dark Self-Image name.
Were you making cassette tapes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we always did from the start. That's pretty much, we just would practice and turn on the tape, and that's where our songs came from a lot of times, were just things that we liked of what we did, just sort of messing around.
And how were you recording them? You were just recording on a boombox?
Yeah, straight into a tape, or an old school tape deck type thing. You know, those really cheap, put the thing in the top and push it down and hit the button. So,
no.
if you want to get really advanced, say again.
Not even one mic hanging, just like the actual tape deck itself, like the recorder built in?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, occasionally we moved up to a microphone or two later, and then, like I say, if you wanted to get fancy and do a couple of tracks, and you could put another tape deck with the pre-recorded track next to the microphone thing at the other tape deck. But anyway, dark ages.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Like early two-track. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty noisy.
How did you transition from that to United Mutation, and when did you guys kind of get serious about it?
I'd have to say we were serious about what we were doing regarding the songs and how we wanted the songs to be and all of that. To the best of our ability, we weren't great musicians at that time by any means. And I'd say it all pretty much happened naturally. It was just like, as we got better, we got a little more, you know, advanced in what we were doing as far as how we were recording and, like, you know, music we were making and all of that. But, I mean, really, a lot of the songs just sort of, like, grew with our abilities, you know, over the time, you know, and were transformed from more garage rocky songs to punk rocky songs, the hardcore songs, and or at least the concepts and some of the ideas, or lyrics at least. And like I said, mainly the same four people, my brother and I, and then we and Monk and John Harden, Monk and Noel basically just kept recording songs, and then eventually we stumbled upon another guitarist and drummer, which was Mike Brown on drums, who became the singer for United Mutation. And that was when Dark Self-Image band started, more or less, when we had a real band. So at that point, we became serious because we actually really had a group of musicians, you know, that were like what we were doing together, writing songs based on, you know, the kind of music we like, being psychedelic music and punk rock music and garage rock and surf music and all that kind of stuff. And started, you know, we didn't really, I don't think we played any shows. We played, or any parties even. I mean, we just sort of played in the basement and recorded some. All those tapes are lost, unfortunately. But we went through stuff like Hawkwind and Joy Division and surf music. And it's like, I mean, it was just all over the board. And at that point, we pretty much were serious. And then when Bob, the guitarist, left to college, we sort of stopped playing for a while. And then we hooked up with Steve Kirkland, who became the drummer for United Mutation later on. And he lived in the neighborhood. So we started the band with him for real. And then he had to leave, and we got Mike Salkind, who ended up playing with us in the original form of United Mutation on drums. And then at that point, we just sort of folded into the whole Discord scene just naturally because of connections and the people we were meeting in the scene. So at this point, still, I think I had long hair at that point still, also probably, like, you know, like serious long hippie length long hair. But yeah, you know, it was. It was cool, you know, like it just all just sort of happened naturally. And then the United Mutation, once we got some records out and stuff like that, it's all been pretty much going from then to now. So, I mean, it's all just happened. So.
All right, well, slow it down for a second and maybe explain, like, what being on the Discord label did for a band from Northern Virginia at that point.
Well, it obviously makes you a little more responsible, because it's not like we were tethered to Discord by any means, but we also had a respect for them, not only from what we liked that they did, but for helping us out. And they helped us out in a way, with a means of supporting other people in Northern Virginia that were coming to them for to put their records out, you know. Like, I think Ian said something like, maybe you can help take up the slack from us a little bit in Northern Virginia, kind of a thing. So, well, not like a subsidiary, but, you know, they were helping us out because they liked what we were doing enough to put their name on our record. They also had a need from a lot of pressure from every band in the world who's trying to get on Discord, which they weren't going to do, but at least locally there would be an alternative. They can say, hey, we work, you know, we've worked with these guys, they're cool, go give them a call. And, you know, a few people did call us, you know, from that, you know, through his, you know, we put, you know, had some connections through some of those type of people. But you know, really it was access to getting shows that we wouldn't ordinarily have gotten, and people noticing us who might not have cared otherwise without the Discord name on it, being able to sell a few more units to a distributor who really wasn't interested in your product to start with, that kind of stuff, getting paid potentially from distributors who ordinarily wouldn't pay you, because there's that responsibility of the connections. So,
Now, did you already have your own DSI label by the time you were kind of partnering with Discord?
That was kind of the beginning of it right there. I mean, we were going to put the record out anyway, but it was sort of like, will we press 500 or will we press 1,000 kind of a thing. And, but I mean, we were going to put the record out. That was going to happen either way. And they said, yeah, let us listen to it and give us a tape and the lyrics and we'll see. And so, you know, that's how basically all, it was that easy. We had been on Mixed Nuts Don't Crack compilation on Outside Records at that point. There was, we'd put some cassettes out at that point, but I mean, just like distribute them ourselves around to certain people. And so, you know, the Discord people had heard our stuff for a year or more at that point anyway, but, the absurdity of Mike Brown's vocals, of course, was also a catching point with people, I think, because it was, nobody had really heard vocals that stupid before, you know? Like just, you know, just like complete insanity shit going on, and it's like, you know, I don't know. That was probably a positive and a negative in a lot of ways, but it was good for what we were doing.
Was the Mixed Nuts Don't Crack put out on DSI?
No, that was Outside Records.
And so, no,
which was done by Laura Lynch. Who was in the band called Nuclear Crayons, which was a Arlington band also. So there's a Northern Virginia band for you.
Ernie was in that band too, right?
Correct.
And so she started the label to put out their records?
Nuclear Crayons, yeah.
And you guys were just friends?
Yeah.
And also...
We went to school together, yeah. So.
And then you were also friends with Media Disease at that point, too?
We met with them around that point, yeah. So, let's see. Yeah, before the record came out, we were... Yeah, but they were, again, it was one of those things where you see them around the mall, or you see them at a show, or you see them... Oh, hey, they're down the street with so-and-so. Like, they're in the neighborhood. Hey, guys. You know, so we met up. Once we met them, we were brothers all, you know, forever at that point. So the Davis and the Cobbett brothers. So it was pretty much, once we got together with them, then it was like, we got a partner in crime here in the Northern Virginia now. So.
Yeah, it's almost like you guys have your own scene.
Well, it was bordering on that, but I mean, again, it was like DC light, you know, at that point, because I mean, are you really, you know, there was no place you would let you play for the most part. I mean, and Northern Virginia, and again, the redneck element of it that just was against anyone who looked like a punk or that kind of a thing. So it was, you know, the clubs were completely against. There was no club. I mean, really, you had to go to DC to play pretty much.
So the tracks that you recorded for Mixed Nuts and the tracks that you recorded that you put out on that first album with Discord, or 7-inch with Discord, were those all recorded at Inner Ear?
All of our recorded material for United Mutations was recorded at Inner Ear. We've done some tracks other places, but all of the recorded released stuff was done at Don's.
And how did you first hear about Inner Ear?
Through the records we were buying that all had Inner Ear, Don's Intera and Inner Ear Studios on them. And sort of like the Dave Grohl story where, you know, it's like, hey, this is right down the street from my house. And I really seriously looked him up in the phone book and called him up and said, hey, are you Don Sentier, the studio guy? And he says, yeah. Yeah, come on by, pick it out. I mean, it was, you know, seriously. Kid.
And were you booking, when you were booking time there, because you guys are pretty young, did you have to book time like in the middle of the night and record at like off hours and things like that in order to do it?
Not necessarily. No, because we were always kind of professional about that too. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had enough money. And we, you know, we've been recording for a couple of years, so we knew the what we were doing by going into a studio. We didn't know what we were doing in the studio, but we knew what we were doing by going in and having someone record it, as opposed to having to just do a lousy tape ourselves. The you know, and there's lots to learn. But I think the first time we recorded might have been on the 4th of July or something, so that would have been an off day. But otherwise, we got pretty much into a routine for a couple of years there. We were going in fairly regular, just, you know, we have a project, let's go in. Because it wasn't that expensive. I mean, it might have been $20 an hour, $30 an hour maybe or something at the most. I mean, it was fairly reasonable. And, you know, I mean, it was, this is what we needed to do. I mean, you had to, there's certain, you know, I mean, you had to get a good instrument. You had to have a fairly good recording. I mean, there wasn't like competition, but it was, you know, the bar was being raised all the time. I mean, when we first started, it was 4-track, just getting into 8-track, then it was 16, and the 20, you know, I'm saying multi-tracking was exploding in the early 80s, and you know, things were constantly changing. I mean, it was new gadgets here, new gadgets, you know, then by the 90s, it was starting to slip into digital, and, you know, so you got a whole different world, you know, developing as we were just getting started in this. So it was kind of a good time in a lot of ways, but yeah, like I say, just sort of learning as we're going.
Who were the people at Inner Ear that were actually recording your album?
Don Zantaro.
He was doing it himself?
Yes, everything pretty much. Co-producing, like guiding us, holding our hand. Yeah. I mean, he was great. I mean, Don is the best guy in the world, really. He really is a super guy. But he really did take us under his wing and, you know, introduced us to Ian and those guys also, you know, like formally, like, hey, come on over. I want you to meet these guys kind of a thing. Where, I mean, he really forced the issue. I mean, he's the fifth Beatle, so to speak, you know. Like, you know, he's the guy who helped us in every way to get us where, you know, we needed to be, you know. So it's like in that connection. And we had connections, like Mike Salkind kind of was connected to Discord, and we had friends who were friends with Discord, and we kind of knew some of the guys just from being around the scene a little bit, but it was not like that welcoming of, hey, great to see you. You know, still, it was kind of like everyone was, you know, and the Discord people, again, on their own credit, were transitioning themselves from being super thrash to moving into something different, too, in the early 80s. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't just like we're trying to fit into your scene, because we, like I said, we kind of had our own scene, and we were happy to have our own scene. And as time went on, we didn't really need the DC scene, because we really did develop our own scene. So. mean, and, once you start doing a record label, nonstop, and you kind of have your own scene. It's like you're busy every day. You're not like just having a party and hanging out and partying all the time. It's you got work to do. You got packages to send and mail to answer and production stuff and all that kind of things that you're actually working on.
Yeah, and so you have to balance, getting your own band together and getting the sound right for your own band with also, the label and trying to help out other bands.
Yeah, and again, with United Mutation, once the record label, once DSI started, then we were in and out of being United. We stopped for a few years, and then we were back with the Rainbow Person. We started playing again around 85 again, and that kind of lasted for a year or so, and then didn't start playing again until 87-ish, and there were various bands in between. Like Mike Brown was in a bunch of bands with Second Wind, and he was in I can't think of names, but Outrage. I think he played with Outrage, and he played with some go-go bands, and Tony Perkins and the Psychotics. So, I mean, he was constantly playing in bands. Jay had their bands, the offshoot bands of United Mutation, like Fat Louie and Fluffy and other bands like that, which were all, Northern Virginia bands. Maybe played a party or two or maybe a show like DC Space or something, but basically not a lot, And we did a band called Bullhead in the 90s that was basically all of us in United Mutation playing together again under the name Bullhead. And, but we'd always throw a couple of United Mutation songs in at every show for the most part. But, as time goes by, you get a little bit better and, you get a little better. And if you keep on doing it, eventually you get better.
Well, speaking of a little better, you brought up, Rainbow Curtain album, and you seem to take a big leap with that album as a band.
Yeah, well, that was a natural progression also, because, again, some of those songs were written several years before, and again, the approach was different, and our drummer was a much better drummer, and I guess we were also relaxed at that point, to the point where we didn't really feel we had to do we can do our own thing, as opposed to what are we doing to fit in, because we're never into the conformity thing, but... Granted, the first EP, Fugitive Family EP, is pretty Discord-y, ASCII-sounding type music. It sort of fits into that mold, kind of. So this Rainbow Person didn't fit into anything. That was kind of the goal there, was just... and then we, in the studio, we maybe put a little too much, fluffy stuff on there to, I don't know. It's all good, so...
Well, let's try to figure that out. Like, what were you trying to do? If you can go back there,
I would say, I would say it's psychedelicizing our punk rock music, which was where we sort of started, because we always were into the hippie psychedelic-y aspect of music, and we loved the hardcore and the punk rock intensity. And that natural meld of the two is something that I guess we've always were into. And again, that was kind of just came out naturally too, because that's where we were doing. We were making weird music at the time. So we liked Hawkwind and all kinds of crazy, you know, psychedelic music and heavy music, and that was just what we're doing. I mean, I don't know how to really. I mean, a lot of the embellishments, I think, were studio embellishments, and you know, not to knock the music at all, because it's, when you listen back to basic tracks, they sound great, and that's, you know, that's just it's not a studio project, because we've done that stuff live too, but it's, you know, that was just a natural progression for United Mutation.
How did audiences or people, when you gave them that record, how did people generally around the scene react to that?
Oh, I think people just thought it was crazy. It was like, again, it was swishy. It has a swishy sound. What's that swishy? It's so weird, man. I can't wrap my... You know, I think it was just too weird for people. I mean, it was slower, which was intended, because we didn't just want to be a thrash band, like just repeating the first records. And, I mean, if you listen to the Mixed Nuts stuff followed by, there's always a progression. The Bowlhead stuff is the next progression from Lice, Flies, and Vermin. Like Lice, Flies, and Vermin, then you have Sensation Fix, okay, which was on, was part of the Rainbow Person basic tracks. And which, interestingly enough, was a song that Mike Brown had written, you know, way before. So it was, had nothing to do with, you know, how, but the progressions into the music and how we record and what we put on top of it and the extra instruments like synthesizer or a sax or something. It's like, you know, again, we've always been trying to build it up a little bit more each time. My brother's doing a band in The Pollution in Colorado now, which is reminiscent of all of this stuff. It's just, you know, the next progression on. So, it was just like I say, a natural weirdness coming out of us. So,
were you able to bring that to your live sets?
Oh yeah, pretty much. I mean, not as much as the swishy, but I mean, as far as the weirdness, yeah, we definitely kind of, like the reverb, any effects that you could throw on, you know, we're fine. We got we played a 930 club and somebody threw all these crazy effects from the PA. I won't mention who, but over the PA while we're playing. So it's like, so there's all this crazy, you listen to the tape and it's just nuts, you know, what the hell's going on here? And we were like, oh, that's so fucking crazy. Oh, I love it. you know, any other band who was hung up would be like, hey, fucking Sabotage, what's that? But people were just like, oh my God, that is the craziest sounding shit ever, you know? And that's kind of what happened with us too. I think when we recorded the Mixed Nuts stuff and we went home and listened to Lice, Flies, and Vermin, and we were like, oh, I'm scared. What the hell? You know, and then we just sort of knew that was the next thing, is we need to build this up. So the next time we recorded Lice, Flies, and Vermin, we threw all kinds of extra shit on there and made it crazy, nuts, psychedelic-y. And that we knew was where the Rainbow Person has to be. It has to come out of that craziness of that last song on the first EP. That's where we have to go with the next record, is we need to pick up where this left off.
Did you guys get a chance to tour around and get outside of the DMV?
No, never. Just Richmond and like down to Portsmouth and Norfolk down there. That's about it.
Because it would have been interesting to see how, you know, crowds reacted to this stuff in Northern California and places like that.
Yeah, it was pretty much impossible. We had I was the oldest and I was 22 or something. And Jay and Mike might have been still in high school, I think, at that, you know, or soon, you know, just out of high school. So it was, we had no cars, we had no money. I mean, our money was being put into records and recording and playing and stuff like that. That was it, you know. It would have been nice, but I mean, it was not feasible in any realm of imagination, even at that point. So there were no deep pockets in our family to help us out, you know.
Well, you guys kept doing it for a long time.
And still do. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's in our blood. It's just the touring thing was just not, you know, that was, you know, just wasn't going to happen. So, and even just getting to, you know, 100 miles away is difficult when you don't have a car. So.
Yeah. Well, I just mean because there might, you know, in the D.C. area and the Northeast, people may not have, you know, taken to your sound or to that sound, you know, but that doesn't mean that it wouldn't have gone over to another place.
Oh yeah, true. And and again, it's like there are places like Northern California and Austin and, you know, places like that, you know, definitely were more akin to what we were doing than let's say Boston or something. But, and again, it was, you know, a bunch of kids all over the country and world just learning what we were doing. And, you know, of course, by the mid-80s, you know, you've got a bunch of knuckleheads who just want to screw things up. And, you know, everybody's transitioning because now we're 25 and that's a whole different world. And, you know, you're falling in love and you got jobs and there's all kinds of other things are going on in your life. And, you know, and then there's, you know, amazingly, this genre of music has lasted this long. I mean, seriously, that says a lot to culture in general, I guess, of, you know, subculture in general or whatever. But
in some ways, it's now as popular as ever.
I think so, yeah. And I think what the kids are doing is great, too, right now as well. So.
Like who? Who are you listening to right now that you're impressed by?
I'm not engaged in necessarily. I mean, it's just what I've seen, you know, like some of the shows we've played. I mean, we played a show up at the VFW Hall up here in Falls Church a few months back. Well, January, I guess it was. And one of Davis's band, I don't know what the band's name is and stuff. They got a guy with a clarinet or something and, you know, some crazy percussion stuff. And, I just love, you know, anything these kids are doing. You know, the Damage City Fest, those guys, and the Coke Fest and all of the bands, you know, that are happening around the DC thing I've been totally impressed by them. You know, it's like, I don't know. I'm not following new music in town at all. So,
well, so back when you were building up DSI, what were some of the first bands that you brought on and how come you brought those bands, you know, onto the label?
Okay, well, DSI was started by Lee West and myself. Lee went to college in Richmond and met up with Death Piggy. So he had financed the first United Mutation record, and he said, we'll put the money that we make off of this into Death Piggy EP. So the first release after United Mutation was Death Piggy. The next one after that was Malefice, which was John Cobbett from Media Disease, new band with Davis White on drums. And that, that had Mike Klaberg on bass.
I was about to say, don't forget Mike Klaberg.
Yeah, he's another integral part. So, and that was pretty much about the time... Well, I'd say because Mike was hooked up with Media Disease through other people. And like I say, it all really happened very naturally, where so-and-so in the neighborhood knew Mike, who knew the Cobbetts and the Cobbetts. And then Monk, who, our singer John, was friends with them. And through his friend's brother, we all lived like 2 miles away from each other. Well, like I said, this whole Northern Virginia scene that we had, our little Northern Virginia scene, was basically PBI, Media Disease, which became Malefice, basically, United Mutation, and Sean Sumner, the drummer for Death Piggy, was the drummer for PBI, and also the drummer for United Mutation first time we went in studio at Inner Ear. So there's a real incestuous bond here as well too. And so it was that was Death Piggy was the second record, Malefice the third, fourth record was United Mutation, and then came Oruku, I think was the which again was a person who lived another band from Northern Virginia that was coming up around the time. So yeah, so it's like, you know, and that kind of was the core as far as the DSI group before the MFD came in the picture, which was somewhere around 85-ish or so, 86, somewhere in that area. So it was, you know, again, it all just sort of happened. I mean, it's like, it wasn't like anyone put a lot of effort into it. It just sort of, these parties sort of all came together and eventually, and we had our little scene. But we still were all tied to the DC thing because that was really about the only place you could get shows. I mean, you could do a party. We had a couple parties we did in 82, 83, somewhere in that area, but not a whole lot, you know.
Was there like a DSI house where you did a lot of work and there was a
pretty much. Yeah, my mom's house was like, you know, the party, you know, mecca of the neighborhood, and it was pretty much nonstop, you know, there for years. I don't know how many, 20 years maybe, I don't know, it was not probably that long. 10 or 12 years, I guess, we did pretty much, you know, a townhouse in Annandale. Falls Church, basically, but Annandale proper.
Wow. Your mom was like the real sponsor behind this thing.
Yeah, she was kind of silent partner. She, you know, she got some inheritance and bought us some amps and stuff. At, you know, when we were probably before, you know, before the first Night of Mutation record, like Dark Self-Image time. And she says, I'm buying this for you, but you got to do something with it. Don't sit on them, you know. And so we did. And ironically, it was oil money, the Sons of Sunoco, going back to Sons of Sunoco. It was Mobil Oil, a Standard Oil stock that actually bought us our amps.
Yeah.
Just saying.
How did Music for the Deaf, like, how did they change MFD things for the label?
Well, I mean, again, as we got better at what we're doing, and like all of us, and connecting with more people. Now, MFD didn't immediately get on the label. They tried for a while, you know, a bunch of different tapes with me, and when the first record, when they dropped that tape in the mail, it was like, yep, they did it. That's it. Let's do it. So, and it was quick. And then Richard's efficient and quick about getting things done, and we quickly became partners. And Mike Klaberg and I had already been collaborating with Malapice and putting out the Mutopia compilation and things like that. So we'd, you know, we'd been working together for a year or so at that point. And then he became the bass player for MFD. And at that point, we just threw it all in, and DSI started working hard and put a lot of records out over several years.
And what... you know, like what kind of shows and what kind of things were you able to put together, you know, with the label's backing for MFD? Like, what were you able to do for them and they, your label?
In a lot of ways, it's what they could do for us, because Richard, like, he had some financial means, and he, like I say, he's a real go-getter, and he likes, he's genuinely interested in what was happening, and he was interested in getting involved, and he was happy to help finance some stuff, and you know, he put the MFD record out. We all started working, like I say, once we started doing MFD records, and we got, you know, started doing all of these different things, all, like I say, 86, 87-ish, 88, somewhere there, and we obviously needed a group. You know, we had Richard working for the label. We had Mike Klaberg and his girlfriend working, me and several other people putting stuff together. So, I mean, we actually were a real label at that point, and we're, you know, selling stuff overseas and, I mean, really going through all the motions other than making lots of money of being a record label. But, you know, it's, you make good connections, and it's still kind of paying off over all these years. I mean, not financially, but I mean, I'm talking to you about it right now. I mean, you know, it's like, this is, you know, 30 years later, it's still, there's some interest, it seems. So that's cool. So, but yeah, it was sort of a mutual, beneficial friendship and collaboration of MFD and DSI and all of the things we could do with that. 'Cause we're all, to do something, and we were doing it. It was right there. It was just happening as we're, you know, as we're doing it. It's like, lo and behold, yeah, you can. Look at that. We didn't know what we're doing. We're just like doing it.
And were they still recording everything? Was everything still being recorded at Inner Ear?
MFD pretty much recorded most everything at Black Pond up in Maryland, which is a small studio up in suburban Maryland. So that's where they did most of their recording.
And what are the albums or tracks that you're most proud of putting out from that time?
Oh, I don't know. I think all of it's pretty great. I think the, I mean, obviously through the whole history, I mean, you know, I like the United Mutation stuff, but I mean, that's my band, you know, so I gotta like that. The Death Piggy stuff is crazy. I love that. I don't know, like Odd Man Out compilation was pretty great. That was a good bringing a bunch of different bands, like bigger bands and bands outside of our little circle together. Mutopia collection, the cassette was great. I mean, that's probably was one of the best things we ever did in a lot of ways for the time and the music that was on it.
And that actually has a band from my hometown on it.
Oh, Pudwack, yes, of course.
Yeah, because I'm from Reston.
Right.
So I have to represent a little bit for the little Reston bands, you know?
Sure. No, they were great, man. And again, look at those guys. They're still, like, you know, they've gone upwards and onwards continuously.
So what is going on with DSI right now and with all of these recordings and pressings?
Well, everything's just sitting here in storage, basically. United Mutations got an LP scheduled to come out this year on Radio Raheem record label in New York, and looking forward to seeing that. That'll be the early tapes, like the first three sessions at Inner Ear, no Rainbow Person. But so that's pretty much in the can, just needs to get finished up. And like covering all, you know, that kind of stuff finished up, and hopefully we'll see that soon. And otherwise, like I say, we'll see what happens. I'm just working on digitalizing old tapes and continuing to the archive, basically organizing and trying to get a handle on all this boxes of stuff I have. So DSI is not an entity at this point at all, but it's not like forgotten or thrown away at all either. It's just like, you know, just the tapes are safe and get lots of stock of certain records. If anybody wants them, you can contact us. Unfortunately, not the stuff that everybody wants for big bucks, but that's okay.
Yeah, because you see people online, you know, and they want those early pressings, and you know, a lot of people are willing to pay top dollar for those records. Get all the time.
I wish I had a few more of them. So I really do, you know, seriously. But
you always repress them.
Yeah, you know, and again, it's sometimes it's best to let it lie for a while, because that's why we have a new record coming out on another label, because we can't do the business, you know, like we did we've done some CDs, like Sean and I, with the DSI archives label, so to speak. And that's basically where DSI is now. It's an archival entity. It's like DSI archives is when we release something, and we often put our name, like the Del Arcos, we put our name on Del Arcos record because they're our friends. And it's just a recognition of them in connection with us, I guess, although it doesn't mean anything really. It's just, you know, it's just a nod, I guess, more or less, and marketing if you want. So, I mean, all of it's really, the whole hardcore scene kind of in a lot of ways was kind of a promotional thing as opposed to being business, you know, with the exception of some labels. But I mean, for most of us, it was really just promoting our releases, you know, promoting our band by putting records out and running an ad in Maximum Rock and Roll or something. It wasn't really about getting rich or starting a label and making money and all that kind of thing. It, you know, it goes along with it, but it's too much work. I couldn't do a record label like I did in the mid-'80s. Now, it's just way too expensive to ship stuff, and, you know, just the time to run back and forth to the post office, I don't have time for.
So what advice would you give to kids who were starting a punk band and a label coming out of Northern Virginia today?
No, I don't know. Like always, just be true to what you want to do and work hard and just do it, man. That's what you have to do is just do it. I mean, get out there on all of the internet or media, you know, Facebook, Instagram, everything, you know, sell it. You know, get out there and let people know who you are.